So today I want to talk about roots, about the Patana condition of roots, Hetu Paccaya. Now, perhaps obviously I'm not intending to talk about plants, so let's understand what I mean with roots. Now, a root is something, in a plant, a root is something that establishes a plant in the earth. But in Abhidhamma, a root means something that establishes the mind in the body, or perhaps more broadly speaking, the mind in matter. So now in Abhidhamma, we have four basic components of reality, but maybe for our consideration, only three of them are important. So now we have matter, mind, and consciousness. And the fourth is Nirvana. So because Nirvana is out of the comprehension of most people, and because it's not directly relevant for the current exploration of roots, I a little bit leave that out. We can say it's the direction of the contemplation that I want to stimulate. But the main important things to consider when thinking about roots, as with any of the Patana conditions, is matter, mind, and consciousness. So the Patana condition of roots, Hetu Paccaya, is about the mind establishing itself in matter. And for the most part, most specifically, in the matter of the body. This is why in my book I called it establishments rather than roots. Now, this establishment of the mind in the body is a very gradual process. So when a being, especially a human being, gets conceived, after conception, after a sperm cell meets with or fertilizes an egg cell, an ovum, in a mother's womb, gradually there develops a fetus in the mother's womb. But that fetus is not only the material side of life, only the material side of a being. So there is a bit of a contention when exactly it happens that a so-called rebirth linking consciousness enters into the equation. Now an entity or a consciousness or a mind stream. Now in Buddhism we have to be a little bit careful how exactly we call it, but something that existed before that newly evolving body will enter and merge with that newly evolving body. And there are differences of opinions, different statements as to when exactly that happens. Some declare that it will happen directly when the sperm cell is fertilizing the ovum. Some give a very definite time of after 7 months of development of the fetus that consciousness enters into that fetus. From my own perspective, I believe it is somewhere after conception and can happen several months after the fetus already developed that this consciousness or mind stream enters into that new being. And when that happens, it only very gradually kind of takes hold of that new being. There is still a matter of choice in that consciousness as to whether it really wants to go for that new life or not. So that's why we sometimes know there are miscarriages. These often can be attributed to that the being just kind of changes the mind. It enters the new body and then it finds the condition not suitable, and then it exits again. it lets go of that body. So it requires some strong, we can say, sort of determination to live a life. Many people with some introspection, they realize, if you want to succeed in life, if you want to really live this life and not give up on it and go for all the difficulties in life, you have to have some kind of determination. And that is a kind of initial determination of this consciousness that it really wants to enter this new life and take on that task and difficulty of living a new life. In Pali it's called Bhava Nikantika Lopa. And that will be a very long process, even when a baby is born already, it will be quite a long process, even into childhood age, that that consciousness will learn to drive the body, to take on the body, and to learn to receive information through the senses, to learn to be identified with the body, and to identify with the needs of the body. And these are all what we refer to as the first root. Now, this is what constitutes the first root. And not only when that is established, gradually the second root develops. But then what is the second root? The second root is the mind's establishment in emotions. So what do I mean with that? An infant, a newly born baby, is almost entirely a physical being. A newly born infant, a newly born baby, is mostly unconscious. Most of the time it sleeps. And only when some stimulus is there, when the mother rocks it, or when some sound is nearby, for example. But then the infant will usually only for a moment become aware. And if the sound is not very disturbing, then it quickly will fall asleep again. That is the condition of a newly born baby usually. But then gradually, these impressions from without get more and more often received into the mind, and the mind investigates what is there. And slowly it will come up with its own sort of designation. It will begin to figure out certain things that are there outside. So usually one of the first things it becomes aware of will be the mother. But when it becomes aware of the mother, not only anymore just as of a sense impression, but starts realizing a certain sequence from impression of mother to a pleasant result in the future, meaning mother, breast, mother's milk, feel good. There's this kind of sequence. Now this will be kind of a very simple sequence that a baby will slowly realize. And once this sequence is established in the infant's mind, then it can sustain its awareness for a little bit longer time. It's not anymore impression. It will start to meet the outside impression from within. So the outside impression is the impression of the mother, and it starts meeting that impression from within and notices now something pleasant is going to happen. So it kind of already anticipates that the result is going to be pleasant. So it starts becoming happy. And happiness is something higher than merely the receiving of an impression. It's a continuous condition of mind, while the former one is only a momentary condition. And then similarly, with negative emotions. No, maybe sometimes the father comes home and he's a little irritated and he starts shouting. And then the mother becomes unhappy, and as a result, she's not smiling anymore at the infant. She looks unhappy. So the child starts to realize that sequence from the initial impression, the father coming home, to the negative result of the unhappiness of the mother and the unpleasant result, the unpleasant situation. So therein the dynamic is that gradually the child realizes this sequence from the initial sense impression to the unpleasant later result. So it begins to move towards the impression. Now when the impression arises again, it begins to move towards this impression and begins to interact with that impression. And it will start mobilizing energy in the hope of preventing the full running of the sequence. Now that is what is anger. The mobilizing of energy to prevent an unpleasant impression to continue to evolve into a negative result. That's a function of anger. And it's the same dynamic with a positive emotion. Now in the positive emotion like happiness, the mind equally meets the impression and starts interacting with it. It starts mobilizing energy in an attempt to make the sequence from the initial impression to the pleasant result happening either faster or happening more intense, or to just ensure that it happens again, just to ensure that the sequence runs properly to the pleasant result. And that will be the basic emotions of infants that an infant will be capable of. And when these become established, then when the child grows up, then more and more complex emotions become possible. Maybe sometimes the child has a sibling, maybe a little brother or a little sister. And sometimes it sees that the little brother or the little sister gets a lot of attention from the mother. And maybe at that moment, he himself feels a little lonely, or he feels not very happy and satisfied. So he begins to see that the initial impression out there is one which will run towards a pleasant result. But it's not going to be my pleasant result. So that's the beginning of feeling envy and jealousy. Now seeing that another person is having something that he would like to have. And of course, if that develops and repeats too often, then slowly the impression of the little brother or the little sister becomes colored with a negative emotion, with a negative perception. So this is how hatred gradually develops. Hatred is a developed form of emotion that an infant is not capable of having. Hatred is a comparatively complex emotion already. And similarly with positive emotions, there are also simple emotions and more complex ones. So sometimes the child has a positive relationship with his sibling, or maybe it's more simple to consider about the mother. So sometimes maybe the father comes home and he gives a present to the mother, or he gives a kiss to the mother. And then the mother is very happy. And then the mother has more loving kindness towards the child. So then gradually the child learns to participate in the positive emotion of the mother. Now it sees the mother happy, then itself, it becomes happy. So it shares into the emotions of the mother. Now that's what is called empathy. And now when the mother is unhappy, then equally it starts feeling unhappy. So the boundary starts expanding. And now of course this is what then gradually leads to emotions like love or sympathetic joy or compassion. Now these are developed forms of emotions. So what we call virtues are basically developed forms of emotion. Now virtues are the perfections of emotions. Now a virtue is when the mind, independent of whether the impression is a pleasant or an unpleasant one, will meet that impression in a positive manner. Now when there's a unpleasant impression, it may respond towards it with compassion or a sense of justice or kindness. Now that is a kind of quality of the virtue, that it will gear both pleasant and unpleasant impressions towards a desirable future, towards a desirable end result. The opposite will be true for vices. Now, a vice is when whether the initial impression is a positive or agreeable one or a disagreeable one, it will gear that initial impression towards an undesirable outcome. Now, when it sees another person experiencing joy, experiencing some pleasant things, then the vice is to experience hatred or jealousy towards it. Or when itself it comes into contact or into possession of, for example, a person comes into possession of money or some positive material goods, but becomes wasteful, not appreciates it, and just squanders it. Now that's what's called a vice. Now the gearing of initial beneficial situations towards undesirable results. So, but then whether with virtue or with vice, but usually when a person at least to some degree is able to control a little bit the emotion, then slowly the third root develops. And the third root is the mind's establishment in intelligence. Now when the mind acquired some amount of ideas and begins thinking about these, then slowly this third root begins to develop. Taking again our example of the infant, the first ideas that an infant will develop is the idea of mother, father. So in Abhidhamma philosophy, that's called a name concept. And when it begins to see relations between these name concepts, between these outside objects, or between itself and these outside objects, then it develops meaning concepts. Now it develops a certain understanding of the relation between different ideas. So it begins to understand, this is mother, she is the one who feeds me, who loves me, who is very good for me. So there you have the relation of the outside object or of the outside idea, of the first idea, towards oneself. And then we already can see that one of the first kind of classification of ideas and outside objects will be a classification between good and bad. So mother good will be one of the first things the child begins to think. But when somebody shouts or when something disturbing is happening around, then that will be bad. It will be classified as bad. So this is the first idea, or the first categorization of ideas. The categorization between good things or good ideas and bad things or bad ideas. And that is a thought. It's no longer anymore just a labeling of a certain object. It's a relation between oneself and the outer object. So then, but then later, growing up a little, it will learn other ideas. Along the line, it learns to think about. For example, if it's a boy, he will learn, he will be taught to think along boy ways of thinking. That will, when he associates with other boys and maybe how the father interacts with him, he will gradually be taught, he will gradually learn how to think like a boy. Same thing with the girl. The girl will learn to think like a girl, and later both will learn to think like a man or like a woman. This is another structure for thinking, another reference for thinking. Similarly, then you will have the next level of framework when thinking of the order of society, not depending on which kind of stratum of society you belong to, on that will kind of depend your way of thinking. So if you're, from the lower stratum of society, meaning you're poor or your family is poor, you don't possess much skill, you don't possess much virtue, you're not particularly intelligent, then usually you will tend to think along the line of this kind of stratum of society. Now you will have thoughts which align with most people of that stratum. Similarly, if you move upwards, if you are belonging to the middle class kind of society, lower middle class or upper middle class, there you equally will begin to think along the line of that stratum of society. You will value certain things that are valued by most of the people in your stratum of society, and you will think along similar lines, and you will make similar decisions. And this is with each stratum of society. If you are belonging to what we usually would refer to as the high society, meaning you are, or your parents are, a famous rock singer, a famous musician, a famous movie star, or you're from a family with several distinguished university professors. In all such cases, in order to associate with a similar stratum of the society that you are in, you will require more refined concepts and more refined ways of thinking than if you would just belong to a middle-class family. Obviously, these are generalizations, but they are generalizations which can help us understand people's way of thinking. And of course, a similar thing applies also for monks, or actually for any religious person. Now, the religious person has, we can almost say, a certain duty to think along the line of a certain frame, which is given by the religion and the doctrines of the religion. So if you want to be a true Buddhist, true Christian, true Muslim, then it is your thinking in alignment with the doctrines of that religion that will make you such. But in either case, whatever your frame of reference for thinking is, now if you understand, this is my frame of reference for thinking, and you attempt, you aspire to think rightly in this frame, then it's going to cultivate and develop your third root of intelligence. So basically the whole structure of society, of culture, these are all means which help a person to think in some orderly manner. And they are all means to give order to thinking, or some structure to thinking. And without any of these reference points, without any of these structures, it's impossible to think. It's impossible to think in any orderly manner. So just as a general statement, we can say the more kind of frames for thinking you possess, principally, the better you will be able to think. Of course, in real life, things are a little bit more complicated. Now, if you have two frames of reference that somewhat contradict each other, then you have a problem. So you will have to find some way to relate these two frames of reference to each other and figure out which one is a more accurate one. And of course, principally, this is a duty of the religious teacher, or maybe also of the philosopher, to explain people how to think rightly and to explain something about the order of the universe, which I was trying to do at least a little bit with this talk on roots or inner establishments. So maybe just as a recap, so that people who study the Abhidhamma may more easily remember what I just said. Now, the first root is the mind's establishing in matter, as most specifically the matter of the body, but also the matter of the surrounding environment. It is a mind's capacity to live a physical life, functional. Then we have the second root, which is the mind's establishment in emotions. It's a capacity to express emotions, the capacity to use emotions to, especially on a social level, being able to modify the circumstances one finds oneself in. And the third root being the mind's establishment in intelligence. So, and the first root is perfected through the development of skill. The second root is perfected through the development of virtue. And the third root is perfected basically in genius. When a person masters thinking, then he perfects the third root. So I hope that was enough for a little bit explaining about the roots of Buddhist philosophy and their meaning and what's the purpose of understanding them.